Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
This is Back Issue Spotlight number 42. We're going to cover Wonder Woman Earth Ones, Volume 1 and 2, and we're doing this in place of what would have been a weekly comic spotlight for the April 22nd, 2020 releases, but hey, there's a pandemic going on, so, you know, we didn't have those releases. So, I'm here with Sam. Again, we're doing the Earth One stuff at DC, and then I'm alternating weeks with James. We're going to keep doing the Doomsday Clock, covering issues 7 through 9 next week, and then Sam, we're going to come back and do, what, Teen Titans Volume 2 and Green Lantern Volume 1 of the Earth 1 stuff, and then back to James to finish off Doomsday Clock. After that, I'm not really sure what the plan's going to be, because that carries us actually through what would be the release weeks of not only May 20th, but May 27th, and Diamond's expected to start shipping stuff on May 20th, but I'm not sure if there's going to be kind of enough output to really sustain the weekly comic spotlight format with enough options, because I've looked at what I'm getting for the 20th, and I'm getting like 5 things from DC, 5 things from Marvel, and like one other book. So it would really kind of narrow the field for a little bit, and that's if stuff actually starts shipping through Diamond on the 20th. It's a wait-and-see approach, I think, with everything these days. So it's a question of when and if we switch back to the weekly comic spotlight, if we keep doing back issue spotlights. If so, probably change up the rules just a little bit, go to like a single trade, kind of a rough limit of about a 6-issue worth of content type stuff, because we've been reading quite a bit for these Earth One hardcovers, and even with just 3 issues of Doomsday Clock, they're pretty intense issues at times. And also, I think if we were to stick with a back issue spotlight format, kind of rotating through DC, Marvel, and the other publishers on a more regular basis. This has been very DC-centric. That was not my intent, even though I clearly picked the stuff, but, you know, hey, it happens. So, listeners, chime in if you're liking the back issue spotlight format, where you could just pick up a trade or two and kind of follow along and help pick what we do well in advance, or if you want us to go back to the weekly comic spotlight format, that helps us have information to make the decision based on. So these Earth One hardcovers, as we talked about before, started getting released in October 2010, and the Wonder Woman Earth One we're going to start with came out in April 2016. These things are coming out on about a 2-year, 2.5-year gap between like a volume of like either Wonder Woman or Superman or Batman or Titans or whatever, which does kind of make the story momentum a little rough in times. But with Wonder Woman Earth 1, Volume 1, and going into 2, I hadn't read these before. I read them back-to-back, so I had zero real problem with the momentum between them. With this first hardcover, which I said again was released on April 6th, 2016, I want to start with a cover for just a minute.
Okay, and I'll say this, just kind of as an aside. I'm with you. I own them and had not read. I kind of grazed the first volume several years ago when it came out. But yeah, I sat down and really read them for the first time back to back as well.
And I think that helps. But again, there was a 2.5-year gap between them.
Yeah. And in some ways, I think it helped. In other ways, they really, in some ways, feel like very different books.
Well, if you look at the cover of Volume 1, mm-hmm. You see that little signature spot?
Yep.
You see that dot, 14 dot?
Yep.
I'm assuming that's 2014?
Yep.
So they had this cover done specifically for this, like 2 years before it saw print. They are running these things as if, I mean, like a movie production kind of a timeline.
Yeah, that's potential. And you're right about the 14. What's interesting is in the back matter, you have several mock-ups for several different covers they kind of toyed with.
Mm-hmm. I think that they're taking a little bit more time crafting the story, getting set up for it. And obviously, it takes a while to draw what, 128 or whatever pages this is. So you need at least 6-7 months, I think, for an artist to really do it justice. And Yannick Paquette here did a fantastic job. But 2.5-year gestation between, I mean, we're getting Marvel movie sequels faster than that, I think.
Yes.
At least pre-pandemic, at least. Now, unsurprisingly, with Volume 1, it's the origin story. I figured we would get that. I wasn't too surprised with that or disappointed with that. When they started off with Hippolyta and Hercules and that whole backstory and stuff, I'm like, okay, it kind of makes sense. That's a pivotal thing and almost gives the origin of the Amazons or whatever. And provided it plays into the story later, which it did, it's like, okay, I'm good with this. And it played in a couple of different ways. What was your thought, particularly in that first scene, although it was used in different ways later, with like the orange panel borders with kind of that ancient looking, you know, maze design? It's got a term for the design, but also the kind of ancient art insets or whatever for panel borders. Did that work for you?
Yes, but it was, I don't know, 10 to 15 pages of it. And I'm glad it wasn't a lot more. I couldn't deal with a whole book of this.
There were other places where we started to get the lasso being used as panel borders, well, and other things of that sort.
Yeah, One, yeah, you could argue it's the lasso. Others would argue it's the strings of fate.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and even they used a mirror at one point, and there are some fun... Boy, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. I enjoy creative panel layouts, mm-hmm. provided they're easy to follow and read in the correct order, which I did not have any issues with this book.
I would say generally it did not impede the reading order at all. There were one or two pages where I could see where somebody might get confused, yep. but only a few places.
Yeah. And like I said, it wasn't done all the time, and I thought it was fairly effective where it was done. So it was clever, it was unique. I didn't mind it here.
I think in the first scene it was a little overpowering, and it was an interesting design choice. I think it added to a couple of pages. It was noticeable to me, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, the first two or three, there's a lot more of it, and there's the crumbling. You know, it's almost like a lot of times you'd see these type of paintings on, like, ancient pieces of pottery and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it's shattering or breaking as the scene goes on.
Mm-hmm. Like they're breaking from the history and kind of, I guess, creating their own or something.
Yeah, or breaking away from what they're going to call man's world. But since you're dealing with Hercules and kind of the Greek gods, specifically that era.
Yeah.
Again, it didn't bother me. It's unique. It's kind of, again, I'm glad the whole book wasn't exactly done this whole way, the same way.
Yeah, it's noticeable. People are either going to not notice it, they're going to like it and stuff, or they're going to hate it. I suspect for most people it's not going to be an issue, but for those that it is, I could see where it could really annoy them.
Yeah.
When we hit that one double-page splash where we're suddenly, you know, 3,000 years later, I mean, the palette changes, we've got just this great opening establishing shot of what turns out to be Paradise Island. I loved that shot. It was very well done.
It is a great shot. That being said, I'm not a huge fan of the composition of the page, with really the left side having virtually nothing in the foreground or to draw the eye to. You could argue the one statue with the raised sword, but that's really the only thing on that entire half of this double page spread. I mean, the focus is all kind of to the right.
Yeah, I think that was intentional. I'm not saying it was a great choice, but I don't think it was by accident.
No, and I'm not, yeah, and again, we can do this double page, and I it might not have been by accident. If it was meant to send a message, I'm not sure, because the rock and the two birds in the foreground on the left-hand page seem to literally be accidentally there.
It strikes me as the kind of two-page splash that could make a wraparound cover.
Yes.
Where all the important stuff is on the front.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that until you mentioned it, but I see exactly what you're talking about there. But given how in some other places, I guess it's the Doomsday Clock, I'm thinking, where we're not getting establishing shots where I thought they were needed, it was nice to start, you know, this scene with one.
Yes.
And then, you know, as we get more into it on the next page and stuff, we see these high-tech kind of sky bikes or whatever they are, a sense of not only the natural beauty of Paradise Island, but the great architecture of it. What looks to be, you know, an invisible skyship of some sort. It's not the classic invisible jet, but it's cool. So I was immediately drawn towards this rendition and version of Paradise Island.
Yes.
So they started, I think, this off on a bit better footing than the Batman and Superman stuff, where our initial look, particularly at the lead characters, was not that flattering and stuff. Now, granted, at this point, we haven't seen Wonder Woman yet. But I did like how, as that plane was landing, the guards that are around are in outfits that are reminiscent of or evocative of kind of the Wonder Woman color scheme and design.
Yep.
So things like that to both denote that they are guards and other people are dressed other ways for other professions, presumably, or whatever. And also, again, leading up to, you know, the look of Wonder Woman being based on Amazon culture, not, you know, American culture, I think was nice. But yeah, introducing Wonder Woman with her being immediately placed under arrest by the Amazons, I thought was an odd choice. It did have the advantage of letting her then, you know, narrate the story to us. So it kind of worked.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this in the past, and I'm not a huge fan of that. Oh, here's a scene that takes place towards the end.
And then rewind to what actually led us there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Generally, I don't like that technique either.
Yeah. The other thing, and I don't know if this is the coloring or this is an odd one, in that very first sequence, when she's kind of let in, mm-hmm. they kind of make a big deal, I'm assuming, about the lipstick is what they're trying to get at.
Yeah.
Yet the coloring of lips of not only Wonder Woman, but other, arguably the sequence we just read, back with Hercules, it looks like Hippolyta would also is at the same shade. If they're trying to make a point about the lipstick, I don't think they do a very good job of it with the coloring in the rest of the book.
I was taking it as they may have had, you know, makeup and stuff back in Hercules' day, but they've gone away from it now, and now here she is coming back with makeup on.
Yeah, but it's not consistent even when you get to the sequence in theory right before this. It's not, again, one of the fates in the middle particularly has much redder lips than the other two. The one in the pink dress, there are times Hippolyta doesn't look like she's got lipstick on, whereas there are times she does. There's even sequences where Diana's shown in the chains and it varies. It's like they really paid attention for like the two or three pages right around that one, but not the rest of the book.
That's fair. That's fair. I can see what you're saying, particularly with the fates and stuff.
Yeah.
It's one where it may be that the colorist either didn't get the full script or didn't read it to that level of detail or just didn't get what they were going for, maybe.
Yeah.
So we get an interesting introduction to her, and she's further down her path because she's already in the Wonder Woman getup and stuff than when we first see either Clark or Bruce over in those books.
Absolutely.
And when we get to kind of the first part of the trial and the backstory, you know, the flashback and stuff, and we get to where she's, you know, helping the deer and stuff, and we get the purple ray. I'm like, man, I haven't seen that in decades, it feels like. That was something that was a classic kind of part of Amazon technology and whatnot back, you know, pre-crisis and stuff. They'd use it to heal people left, right, and center and stuff when they could. But it's kind of rarely been seen since Crisis, or probably more appropriately since Legends, when that kind of kicked off the George Perez Wonder Woman era, where he got a lot more mythological and a lot more grounded in that stuff versus almost the kind of fantastical fantasy stuff that they'd used before. So it was nice seeing a lot of things being brought back into continuity, at least in this world. And it shows that these are people, I mean, Grant Morrison's the writer, so I expect this. They you know, he knows his stuff. It's not just, well, I've watched the Wonder Woman show in a movie or two, so I must be able to write, you know, Wonder Woman just fine. Clearly, he's done some research. There were a lot of other things I saw throughout this that were pulled from the Golden Age. And admittedly, it was lost on me until I did a quick, you know, Google search for like Mala and the Swan Ship and some other stuff like that. And realized, oh, this stuff goes back to the early days of the character.
Yes.
Which I thought was really cool.
No, I tend to agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, Mala reminded me a little bit of the Cassie version of Wonder Girl, just, you know, the blonde hair and such, but to find out she was a Golden Age character that kind of got cast aside in the Silver Age and stuff. I mean, to me, it added something to this for them to be pulling those kinds of characters out and yeah, putting them back into use.
I tend to agree with you. Mala, actually, and again, Cassie is a character I love. Reminds mm-hmm. me a great deal of her. Not just the look, the attitude, the youthful exuberance. There's a lot of things about her that remind me of about Cassie.
Yeah. The other champions we get a little bit later were very clearly based on the Donna Troy Wonder Girl, on Artemis and stuff like that. So there's an aspect of knowing where the Wonder Woman mythology had gone in the mainstream comics and, you know, planting those characters throughout this story. I don't say preemptively, but, you know, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when we get the seeing mirror or whatever it was, again, that kind of goes back to the sort of magical technology that the Amazons had pre-crisis and such. The one thing that, and this may seem like a nitpick, but it struck me as just a little odd. We're getting the captions in yellow of what's being broadcast and stuff, and it looks like we're getting the World Trade Towers, you know, getting knocked down or whatever. But the dialogue from the footage has different punctuation marks. It's got like a greater than and two dashes to begin with, and then two dashes and a less than after it.
Whereas I'm trying to find this, because I'm not sure where we're at.
It's when we've started going into the scene with the purple ray after the deer, right after we've been introduced to Mala on that next page.
Got it.
When she's going to see her mother.
Got it.
Normally, when they do foreign text being translated, it's just in kind of the greater than less than brackets. It doesn't matter, but it almost felt like they were, I don't say untranslating it for us, if you know what I mean.
Well, see, to me, I just look at it more, well, they chose to use dashes, more as like ellipses, where they're just telling us it's incomplete, it's a fragment of a sentence or a thought, as opposed to the full thing.
Okay, that's fair, that's fair. I just took it, since Diana didn't recognize the language, that it was also doing a translation thing.
That's possible, too.
But that's one of those things where the visual language of comics, I feel, has kind of degraded a little over the decades, just because different people choose to do things their own way every time, and what used to be kind of a standard convention is stopped being one in many ways.
Yep.
Which, again, not a big deal. I thought it was interesting that we got the story of how Diana was created from clay and given life from the gods. I'm like, oh, that's cool. We got that part of the story kind of, you know, here, and that's her origin in this world, at least as we're told, and as far as she knows at this point. But it goes back to, you've always got to take at a story things through the lens of who's telling you this. Is it the narrator who should be honest and upfront? Or in this case, is it one of the characters telling it to another character, and they may have an agenda as to what they're telling and why?
Yeah.
Cutting back and forth to the trial scene again, and we keep getting the three fates. All of those shots where we get the three fates, while they're interesting, it's well drawn and stuff, I didn't care for those characters, and those cameos didn't really add anything to the story for me.
Oh, see, okay, I saw it a little differently.
Okay.
I kind of think they are integral, and in many ways, again, kind of classic Greek tragedy. You're dealing with the theme in this book, to me, is very different than the theme in the next one. And the theme in this one is kind of partially the hero's journey, but more, there's a lot of the idea of fate and not being to outdo your fate and not always understanding your fate, even though you were kind of told about it previously. And that really becomes true, I think, with the oldest of the fates towards the end, when she cuts the one string and
mm-hmm.
and you realize, oh yeah, that's kind of what they had told you was going to happen all along, but it isn't what you thought was going to happen, even though it was perfectly clear that was what the fate had always been.
Yeah, I do think the can you choose your destiny or is it written out for you is definitely a major theme, and as such, having the three fates makes sense. I just felt that they were seeing it from afar. It was unclear why we were seeing them but none of the other gods and some stuff like that. I don't disagree that they should have been in the story. It's just the way they were in there felt a little weird to me.
Well, and we do get, and again, this is more in the next one, but we do get, while we don't see them, we do get references to some of the other gods quite heavily and in some ways quite importantly in these two books.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Where this story, I don't want to say fell apart, but they're having the whole party thing. Diana's playing the role of Hercules for the reenactment stuff, getting chased through the woods and stuff, which was, you know, fun, some great art there and stuff. But then she's walking along the beach and just stumbles across this wreckage of this jet. And it's like, this jet crashed and washed ashore. They're none the wiser. She literally just stumbles across it. That felt like happenstance.
Yes.
Ironically, this would have been a good place to put the fates to steer her in that direction, kind of a thing, maybe.
Yeah, and it's interesting because while it comes out of nowhere, it's basically that sequence is two double-page splashes.
Mm-hmm.
And even the night scene when she's hiding in the tree right before that feel much... The first double-page spread and the two pages before that and the kind of the night are much less well-rendered, maybe. It almost feels like, A, the book could have existed without those four pages, and maybe originally did, and some editor went, that's too big a jump, and they added those pages later, particularly the first one where she comes across the wreckage.
I was going to say particularly the second one where he's coming out of the water.
See, that one I disagree with. That one I think was Steve Trevor's rendered differently than the Amazons are kind of all throughout this book. And Diana on that page is rendered very similarly to the way she is in the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back to the double page spread before, particularly the lower one where she's holding the lion's head.
Yes, that one is lacking in detail.
Yeah.
It's particularly a nose.
And definite lots of things. And
yeah.
Yeah, it almost feels like those four pages may have been added later by an editor because they thought it was really too abrupt without them.
Yeah, definitely, I think, particularly in that first one, the two panels down in the bottom right where she's got the head and she's almost sketched out versus drawn.
Yeah, well, and even the one opposite that, where she's in the distance carrying the head along the waterfront.
Yeah,
close-up where she's kind of looking up. It's rendered differently. That one's not a lacking of detail, but it is rendered very different.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a good reference. Well, no, I guess the headband's kind of the same, but it definitely feels like, well, actually, that close-up of her on that first two-page spread almost could have been like Nicola Scott or somebody.
Well, yeah, and...
I'm not saying it was, I'm just saying...
No, again, it's referenced, it's just rendered... If you look just to the next page where you're back at the trial, and the women's faces kind of have that traditional softer curve women's faces and stuff. And there's not a lot of dark line. Whereas that one close up there on that double page spread, the way the hair is, the shadows under the chin, it's rendered very different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it also looks like it may have been smaller and then enlarged or something.
Yeah.
Something was going on there. In that second two-page splash, we do see the jet still above water, so apparently it just crashed. He's parachuted out or whatever, and he's getting to land. And this is where we're introduced to Stephen Trevor, who at this point is we find out a little later in a few pages, a flight commander, I think it was, a flight lieutenant. So, lower rank than we usually see him. And much like we got the female Lex Luthor over in Superman, the female Two-Face for Batman and stuff. We get a male Steve Trevor, but can't have him be white. Gotta shift up the ethnicity and stuff. Which at this point is feeling almost a little cliche to recast the character to a different gender or ethnicity. And I'm not saying this is anything new. The same sort of thing happened in the 80s when we got new versions of some classic Earth 2 characters of Dr. Midnight and some other, you know, Wildcat and some other characters. I get that there was a surplus of white male heroes originally, and we need to have better diversity in comics. I'm all for that. But there's a question of, do you take an existing character and recast them, or do you just bring in a new character?
Yeah. Again, this one doesn't bother me. Different world. This one, I didn't even think of it till you just mentioned it. I just went, okay, that's Steve Trevor. Okay, that's the, you know, I don't know why, it, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. It just, it didn't strike me at all until you just said something.
It reminded me of the Ultimate Nick Fury.
See, it's weird. There's another character where it doesn't bother me much, but okay.
I'm not saying it bothers me. I'm saying I noticed it.
Okay, that's another character. I wouldn't even say bothers. It's another character where I barely notice it.
It feels like at times that they're trying to fix things from the past in terms of how these characters were originally created or whatever. And I'm not saying this is a good change, a bad change, or anything. I'm just saying it is a change.
Mm-hmm.
And it was noticeable more because they'd done it in the Superman and Batman books as well in some way, shape, or form. More than if this had been the first Earth One, I would have said, oh yeah, they did that. Okay, whatever. You know, it just seems to be almost a, you know, who do we expect? What character in like the Green Lantern one do we expect to get recast? You know, is Carol Ferris going to be, you know, a different ethnicity or something like that? Or I don't know. I'm just curious. I was more surprised that his rank was lower than it had been in other versions of the character.
I'm trying to think, what is normal for a test pilot?
That's a great question. I don't know.
I mean, I know like the early Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong and stuff were all kind of by rule in the early days of NASA Navy test pilots, and most of them were junior grade lieutenants.
Okay. I have no basis for what it would be in reality. I was just going to, he's usually a captain or a major or a colonel or something in the comics.
Yeah.
That's all the reality I need.
Fair enough.
The one scene that really I thought was different than would have played out in most other comics, other time frames or whatever, was when Diana and Steve have their first conversation and, you know, she's never seen a man before. She gets a little hands-on with the discussion, we'll say.
Okay.
Which, out of the entire book, there's a few places where, I don't know what rating this got. If it was teen plus or all ages or what. But this is one of the places where, I'm not saying it crossed a line, but it was at least getting close to it.
Okay.
If somebody wanted to be offended, I think they could find one or two panels to be offended by, is I guess what I'm saying.
But that's generally true.
That, absolutely. Not arguing with that at all. And there were also a few places here where I didn't think the art was quite as good as it had been in other places. We see some panels where her eyes are just all in shadow.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad, but in many of the other places in the book, it's just so great that it was noticeable.
Yeah. And like I said, Steve Trevor is rendered differently, as you would expect for the one male character, than all the rest of them. And I don't want to say it comes off as worse, but it's different, and it's almost a different style as well, so that can come off as worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get what you're saying there. Overall, I like this version, both of Wonder Woman and of Trevor. Matter of fact, I probably like this version better than the New 52 Rebirth version, because I think that one's just got no real direction or whatnot.
Yeah.
When we get back to the flashback scenes, or the trial scene, I guess. Actually, no, hang on. Where the hell are we? I get lost in this thing of, are we bouncing in time or
well,
no?
The page she's after the cave scene, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, that's the one I was referring to, because we've got some interesting panel layouts, including a middle stretch in kind of the W kind of shape or whatever. But when we get introduced to, from New Athens, the other champions, and this is where we get Troia and Artemis, although we don't get their names until later.
Yep.
And again, I liked seeing other kind of familiar faces.
Yep. And even, while not an exact replica, definitely close to Donna's classic outfit.
Mm-hmm. Definitely evocative of it.
And again, minor nitpick, Mala in the lower right-hand corner of that page.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly appears to be wearing a blush or a rouge, again, for them to have made such a big deal about makeup a few pages earlier.
Yeah, I guess you could argue a shadow maybe, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think if they were going to go with that kind of a stand on the makeup, they should have really clued in the colorists a little better. I didn't really notice it while I was reading the book, so it didn't faze me at all, but I can definitely see where you're coming from. I also like on the next page where we get the bullets and bracelets kind of action with their ray guns and such. This is another one where the panel borders are kind of the red stars on the yellow background, the top one doing a W. What I found interesting is it's a 6-pointed star here versus a 5-pointed star. I mean, it doesn't matter, but to me it felt like they were trying to be evocative of, like, the Linda Carter TV show era. I just don't know why they went with the 6-pointed stars.
Well, and it's an... Yeah, and again, you'd have to see it. It is much closer in shape and design to a fat asterisk symbol than it is to, say, the Star of David.
Yeah.
When you think 6-pointed stars.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, it's a unique kind of 6-pointed star.
I like how they're using the kangaroos for mounts and doing the jousting and stuff. It's a cool visual.
It is a cool visual. That being said, maybe I just don't have enough history with Wonder. Are kangaroos traditionally a normal part of the landscape of Paradise Island?
I don't know, because it's been so long since... I mean, to me, we're talking kind of the pre-crisis Paradise Island, and it's been so long since I've read any of that stuff. I want to say yes, but I honestly, I don't recall.
Yeah, like I said, I enjoyed it, but I kind of thought, boy, who had the really random and kind of cool idea to use kangaroos instead of horses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely gives it a different look to it and stuff, and it makes it seem a little more exotic and kind of cool. This is where things, you know, veer a little away from the classic origin, yet stay with the classic origin. The nature of the contest and the battle and stuff is almost a historical reenactment in which Diana kind of, you know, goes off script and wins, mainly so she can go get the Mala's swan plane, so she can basically take Trevor home.
Yeah.
What I hadn't realized while reading it, but I had done a quick Wikipedia search afterwards, Mala and the Swan Plane, classic Golden Age stuff.
Fair enough.
So, again, I appreciate that kind of stuff. And I like how they were setting the scene from the first moment we saw Paradise Island for things like the Invisible Jet and things of that sort. I do think it was a little maybe sexist of Hippolyta to think that the only explanation for this madness of why Diana is doing all this stuff must be a man.
Yeah, again, that's a much bigger issue for me in the next book.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah.
It just seemed to... Surely there were other explanations.
Yeah, and there's the really odd image in the mirror on that page that's not explained or dealt with well.
Where she's kind of trying to tell her how horrible man's world is.
Yeah, but... It's interesting because you've got the line, kind of the last line on the top of that page, you humiliated your sister Mala. And the image directly below that, that character looks like Mala amazingly, yet it's not, and it's kind of a weird random image.
Yeah, I couldn't tell where that image, it seemed like a collection of images just slammed together.
Yeah, it's like three random images kind of thrown together into one single image, maybe four even.
Probably four, but yeah. I don't know where they were going with that. It didn't work well for me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that particular image being confusing. Or,
you know, her getting Trevor off the island and stuff, okay, that's going to happen. It was a little unclear to me if man just shouldn't set foot on the island, or if there was an actual problem if he did, because in some past continuities of the mainstream stuff, there was a big taboo. They literally could not do it, or the Amazons would lose their immortality or something like that. So, you know, where they were going with that. And Diana leaving on bad terms, I thought was an interesting decision, story-wise, for the writer to make. Not saying it was right or wrong, I just surprised. She was not going out as the ambassador for Paradise Island. She was going out as an outcast.
No, but she tried to, again, I think this switches somewhere between the two volumes. It feels like she tries to present herself as an ambassador to man's world, at least in this volume.
I think a little in this volume and at the beginning of next volume.
Okay.
She's certainly seen that way, whether she presents herself that way or not.
Yeah.
And again, we get one or two panels where we're cutting back to the narration of these events versus these events as they're flashing back, which I get the framing sequence, not keen on that story technique, but that's what they went with. The departure from Paradise Island and how it's behind the storm and all that kind of a stuff, again, this is how it's not discovered. It's kind of a classic part of the mythology or whatever. So I didn't really have any issues with that. Where things got a little weird for me, and this is just, you know, where my mind goes. We finally get to Man's World, and she's taking him to a hospital. How does she know what a hospital is? How does she know where one is? And where did she park the plane during all of this? Because she just walks right in carrying him. Hey, he needs help. The other thing I started to notice around this point, and it was a little more obvious later when we were in the hospital, is I was trying to figure out when this story was taking place.
Okay.
We don't really see many clocks. We don't see watches. We don't see cell phones. We don't see many computer monitors, or at least enough to get a sense of are they flat screens and clearly date the technology.
Yeah, which is probably a good choice.
Not saying it's a bad choice, but it wasn't until I was starting to wonder when this took place that I was starting to specifically look for those hints and realized they did a great job of not putting them in there and not being obvious that they weren't in there. I didn't care for the introduction of Medusa and stuff. Logical character to bring in. I get why they did. Just didn't care for the character, but that's not necessarily their rendition than just in general. I also felt when we got back to the hospital, Wonder Woman went from not speaking English to learning it really quick. And I was puzzled how it just came to her.
Yeah.
I mean, literally within minutes of meeting that nurse or whomever she's talking to with I Learn English, she's, oh, you all look so small, so sickly. I mean, she almost goes fluent fast.
And again, we have no frame of reference for how different her native language is.
I always take it as kind of an ancient Greek or something of that sort.
Which would be extremely different as opposed to one that's just, well, it's just English. It just develops slightly differently, more like a regional dialect, which is where something like this would be more understandable.
Right, right. She doesn't kind of react well to the situation of the patients in the hospital and I guess in her mind how barbaric it may seem.
I don't know if it's barbaric's not necessarily the right word.
I guess she's not used to seeing people that are not in the prime of health, like all the Amazons she's grown up with for the last millennia.
Yeah, exactly. They're not immortal.
Yeah.
She even makes the comment at some point about, what world is this where... No, that's... where was it? I just saw it.
What world is this where women perish alone, afraid, or cower before a whelp of a man? I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, no, I saw that, but that's not...
Okay.
There's some place where she says this whole world is decay and everything... it's two pages before that. These terrible smells that mask only decay. This artificial stuttering light. The nightmare. I think she's just not used to death.
Yeah, she's never seen people in this state.
Yeah, it just doesn't exist where she's from, kind of.
Yeah. Well, again, she's used to Amazons that are in the peak of physical perfection and immortal.
Yeah, and they don't age. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, the line about decay and the elderly woman she first comes, you know, she just, the concept of aging, you know, which is why it's interesting, and I understand, obviously you got to cut. It would have been interesting if somehow she had wandered into a nursery in here somewhere, because she also would have no concept of the opposite side of that.
That actually would have been a nice thing for a nurse to have, well, let me show you this.
Yeah.
And that could have lifted her spirits or something. Absolutely. That would have been a great scene. Instead, she basically goes out and encounters the army and starts throwing jeeps around.
Yes.
Which, you know, I get why they went there and all of that. I guess I was a little confused how she went from flying off from there to meeting Elizabeth Candy, who's the next witness at the trial that we jump back to, and her friends on the bus is going to go off the side of the road or whatever, but gets saved by Wonder Woman. You know, what was she doing there? Why did she how was she there to save the bus? I didn't get it.
Yeah, that's fair.
It was a way to bring Elizabeth Candy in. She's a classic version of Etta Candy, another character that dates back to the 1940s. We've seen many versions of her over the decades. So having her as the friend, the confidant, whatever, makes sense. I think she was well used both here and in the next book. So I get why they brought her in, and it's a little bit of a different take than we kind of have typically seen, or not typically, but than we've seen more recently, where she's been either a military person or a special forces kind of a person. Here, she's literally a sorority girl.
Yeah, which, again, certainly a different take.
And not a bad one, necessarily. But again, just you know, they're going in some different directions with these characters, as you would expect when they're doing a reboot or a new version or a new world of the character.
Yep.
The whole relationship with Trevor and the military personnel and stuff, you know, what happened to the $100 million aircraft and all this kind of stuff. I was never quite clear what he was out there doing, if he was specifically looking for them or whatever. We get hints and stuff, but I couldn't even tell which of these guys he reported to.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
I mean, they all don't seem to know him directly. He doesn't seem to know them directly. So the chain of command was a little unclear. Them deciding to use Steve Trevor as I don't want to say a babysitter or whatever, but somebody to keep track of Wonder Woman as they're trying to figure out what to do. Interesting, some of the stuff in the hotel scene.
Yeah, see, this is where this book and the next one start to kind of go off the rails, for at least me personally.
I think they were going and bringing some of the aspects of the Golden Age stuff into this with a modern sensibility, and walking the line of, they didn't do anything blatantly inappropriate, but it certainly made for some awkward moments.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
And again, I can see where the source material gave them the, well, we could go this way with it. So I don't think it came out of nowhere either. But it also, I think, was trying to underscore how different the world she grew up and lived in was from the rest of the planet.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah, this is where the submit to loving authority thing starts, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I said, personally, this is where, to me, it starts to kind of go off the rails.
I can understand that and don't disagree. I don't think they had set that aspect of Amazon culture really up.
No.
So at this point, it's like, where did this come from? The collar or whatever? How did she get that from the bellhop or whatever? What's going on there? There's things had to happen to get it to this point that we didn't actually see.
Exactly.
We spend a fair amount of time in the hotel up until Medusa shows up. I was surprised that Trevor had gotten hit by Medusa and turned to stone. For a moment, I'm like, I don't know if this can be undone or not, but it's Steve Trevor. If he'd gone by a different name, he could have been toast. And then we would introduce Steve Trevor. But no, it's got the right name, so we're going to have to cure him somehow. And
he could have had a sister, Stephanie Trevor.
Yes, you're right. He absolutely could have, and may still. At this point, though, we'd seen the purple ray. We know Diana is a miracle worker with it, so I wasn't too worried about him. This was also one of the few places where we see a cell phone in use in the story, when Candy is calling for reinforcements.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The other thing that gave a hint as to the time frame was she's got like a circuit diagram on her dress or her blouse or whatever. So for me, that at least put it, you know, in the 80s or beyond. There was a few places where we get a little bit of profanity here. Not too much, but it's like, yeah, it's not really adding anything to it. And it felt a little out of place. And, you know, this is where we get to the point where we've come full circle to get the flashback events up to the point of the trial back, you know, on mm-hmm. Paradise Island. I don't know that the flashback approach was the best way to tell the story. That's the way they decided to go, though. Him getting cured by the purple ray again, wasn't too surprised by that. Getting, you know, is this her fate? Is this her choice? You know, as you said, they were building up to this the entire time. What I found most interesting about the way the story ended was we get a page or two where she's back in man's world now, presumably with the blessing of the Amazons or whatever.
How about that?
It was hard to tell.
Yeah,
she wasn't.
Yeah.
It was on better terms, whether they wanted her there or not, they at least acknowledged she was going.
Well.
But we end on a note that didn't telegraph where the next book had to go.
No, absolutely. But yeah, again, she's, and we were talking about it, these are all kind of spoiler filled. I mean, it ends with Hippolyta leaving, or abdicating, or whatever you want to call it, and her becoming queen. And so at that point, when she leaves.
No, Hippolyta was becoming queen.
Was she?
Yeah.
I am completely confused by this whole story.
Because Hippolyta said she's going or whatever, and...
And Nubia reminds her that it's eternal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. But again, it's not necessarily the blessing as much as they've accepted that that's the fate.
Yeah, whether they agree with it or not, they acknowledge it's happening and are not fighting it and trying to haul her back home.
Yeah, yes.
And this is where we get the three fates actually interacting with the characters.
Yep.
And such. I didn't take them as having been in that physical space the whole time. And maybe they were, maybe they weren't. I don't know.
Okay.
Overall, I liked a lot of these characters. I like this Wonder Woman. I think she's probably the most heroic of the Earth-1 characters we've kind of talked about so far. So I'm excluding the Titans and Green Lantern because I don't remember Book 1 of the Titans and I haven't read Book 2 or Green Lantern Book 1 yet. I like this character kind of better than I like the Superman or Batman of this world.
Yeah, when I finished this book, I liked this character. Now that I've read the second book, I really dislike this character. And having read the second book with hindsight, looking through this again, I see the seeds of why I dislike the character in the end of this book.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
Ultimately, she's an authoritarian. If everyone would just submit to me, we'd be fine. It is the worst virtue in all of humanity, and it's not heroic.
That's fair. That's fair. I definitely think more so in the second book, absolutely, she exemplifies that.
Absolutely.
Overall, I thought this probably did the best job of the volume ones we've read so far. Launching a character, setting her up, acknowledging the past of the character in the comics, yet going their own way. And I felt set the character up decently for the modern age.
Yep.
Again, I was a little unsure, for the most part, when some of this was taking place. You know, up until, again, we get to that final page or two and see another cell phone and a few things like that. But overall, I liked it. I thought it did what it needed to do in terms of setting up the character.
Yep.
Shall we dive into book two?
Sure.
Now, this is another one where we start with a flashback scene. This time, however, it's World War II. So it's taking place, obviously, after the Hercules scene at the beginning of the first book, but before most of the events of the first book. And it makes me wonder, since we started with two flashback scenes, if when we get a third volume, and I am expecting to get a third volume based on how this one ends, if it too is going to start with a flashback, and if that's just kind of the formula, storytelling-wise, they're going with.
Yeah, it's entirely possible.
Now, having this initial scene set World War II era with Germans and stuff like that, obvious place to go given when the character was created and kind of the ties to World War II just in the history of the character. This Paula Van Gunter, she too dates back to the early 1940s, is part of the Golden Age continuity and stuff. Obviously, it's a slightly different version. I enjoyed seeing early on, you know, Troia and Artemis and Hippolyta, so obviously they've been around for a while. And explaining why Diana wasn't part of this battle and this scene. What I particularly liked was when Diana is starting to try to get involved and stuff, the Amazons are already hauling off these Nazis using the Space Transformer to take them to Aphrodite's world where Queen Zira, or whatever, and her butterfly-winged Venus girls await to purge them of their need for conflict. And I'm like, I don't know who this queen is, but does she really appreciate you dumping Nazis on her doorstep? Or Space Transformer step, I guess it would be?
Yeah, there's so much. This is where I really lost interest.
How so?
From Hippolyta's speech on, everything she says is the exact opposite of peace is our weapon, love is our shield, war is not welcome here. Okay, so what does she do? She brainwashes it. As long as you're brainwashed by me, it's good. When you're brainwashed by the Nazis, it's... No, brainwashing people is evil, regardless of whether or not you think you're doing it for the good reason.
Were the Nazis trying to brainwash them or subjugate them and enslave them?
No, but it's implied she had been brainwashed.
Yeah,
And the first thing Hippolyta does is, oh, I'm just going to brainwash you my way instead of their way, and somehow that's good. No,
I agree that the whole bit of we're going to send you off to this place to get brainwashed struck me as just weird on multiple levels.
Yeah.
I don't know if this Space Transformer thing is from the Golden Age or not. I didn't think to go look for that. It feels like the sort of thing that very well could be.
Yep.
I was curious about the butterfly-winged women and stuff, and we actually do see them almost later on. The other thing that puzzled me was when, after she fights Paula and such, and Diana's asking what's going on, Paula, I don't think, has given her name at this point, yet Paula seems to have it to give to Diana.
Yeah.
So they were doing stuff here to set up things later. I just don't think it was effectively done in a few ways.
Yeah.
Now, the whole bit of Paula living on Paradise Island for a while and all that stuff, again, goes back to previous versions of the character. So I can see where they're drawing inspiration from what had gone before and trying to make it their own. Yeah. Now, when we cut to the meeting scene where everybody's got these VR goggles on, that just read kind of funny for me for a couple of reasons. One, we're recording this. There's still the stay-at-home orders in a lot of the world, and certainly a lot of the United States. So doing a meeting through virtual reality, there's a certain part of that that makes sense. Doing it through virtual reality in person seems hilarious to me. Wouldn't they keep, you know, bumping into each other and stuff because they can't see where they are?
Yeah, sure.
I've seen one or two really good YouTube videos where they're doing this virtual meetup and the guy's gesturing and knocking things over left, right, and center and stuff. It just came to mind.
Yeah.
It just seemed weird for them to have the VR goggles on, yet they seem to be a projection in the middle of the room of Paula and stuff. It seemed like an attempt to go high tech that didn't quite work. The other thing, when we get the cane that's going to identify Dr. Psycho later and stuff, okay, whatever. When we cut to Wonder Woman hitting the baseball, the softball, whatever, out of the park, I was puzzled by that because it then goes to a completely different stadium right into the glove of somebody sitting there waiting as part of this event or whatever.
Is that not her as well? No, because I guess they're high-fiving, but so they're not the same person.
It's not her.
It's hard to tell. She looks very similar.
Yeah. She can hit it far enough to get to another ballpark. I got no problem with that. The aim is what I have issues with.
Fair enough.
Because it just lands right in her glove. And I couldn't tell what was going on. Was this televised? Whatever. It didn't, you know, mean anything, but to hit it right into the glove of an outfielder or whatever, just I didn't see how that worked. And again, this is her being accepted in man's world as a celebrity of some sort. You know, part of a parade and all of that sort of a thing. So a little time has clearly elapsed since the first book. It was unclear to me how much time had elapsed, because I don't think they gave any solid clues between in this book as to how much had transpired.
Mm-hmm.
When we get some of the stuff of the whole politics and all that stuff, it felt a little exposition-y and a little heavy-handed of, well, we just need to kind of do this dump of information early on, which I'm not saying they should have played out those events or something. It felt a little forced, a little awkward. It was well done for that sort of thing. I just don't care when that sort of thing's done.
Yeah.
Getting the telepathy device, I'm not even sure if they named what that was or whatever, so she could call home. That I do think is from the Golden Age, maybe even last a little into the Silver Age and stuff. I don't recall. It feels familiar, though. And of course, we've got to cut back to Paradise Island and set up the whole stuff with Paula of things aren't going to end well. Because, well, you know, she's a Nazi. What do you expect? When we get to see Steve in this, and he's in this jet, and they're going to go have a race between the state-of-the-art, you know, concept jet that the government's got and her, you know, Amazon tech invisible jet, I'm like, man, that's not going to end well for him. And he was feeling at this point more like what I would have expected Hal Jordan to do than Steve Trevor.
Yeah.
Not a problem, just felt a little weird.
I'm also not exactly sure what happened and went poorly there.
He pushed it too far and put the plane under more stress than it could handle, which again seemed more like a Hal Jordan move than a Steve Trevor move.
Yeah, it does. Again, knowing enough about flight engineering, that's not quite the way things work, but okay. Because he's not maneuvering. He's simply trying to go faster in a straight line. And it randomly blows up.
I'm assuming, I mean, not that we see it shaking or something, but it feels like it's under stress of some sort.
Yeah.
Like they put too powerful of an engine for that jet.
For the body, that's possible.
But it could have been explained better. What gets me is on the next page, Wonder Woman is on the outside of her jet.
Yep.
Canopy's still down, whatever. Okay. She swan dives from there to his jet, to go pull him out, but then rides his parachute down. So she can jump from jet to jet, got great aim and stuff, but doesn't seem like she can fly, which is makes sense. Some versions of the character she can, others she can glide on air currents, whatever, others she can just jump well.
Well, and again, I'm not sure how much of that necessitates her as much as it is for Steve.
True, true.
You don't want to leave a man parachuting who may be passed out or incapable of controlling his own descent either.
Yeah. It also, though, clearly implies the invisible jet's fine without her.
Yes.
Which, unsurprising, the whole radio telepathy thing, whatever. But man, this guy goes through jets pretty often.
Well, test pilot's not an easy job.
I don't know that they've said he's a test pilot.
Well, you keep giving him special high-tech planes that they don't seem to know the capabilities of. Sure, sounds like a test pilot.
Yeah, or they just don't like him and are trying to kill him.
Yeah, also true.
Either way, it's bad for the jets. When we cut to the Pentagon and we start hearing about Project Ares, A-R-E-S, you know, dots and stuff, an acronym or whatever, I'm like, man, that just sounds bad. You know, with a name like that, can't be good. And of course, we don't go investigate immediately. We cut away to something else.
Yes.
A little annoying. What we cut to winds up being about an 18 or 20 page chunk of story in the Middle East where a negotiator has been captured. He's trying to negotiate the release of some girls and stuff. So Wonder Woman's got to go bail him out. I found her outfit for this very interesting. It felt vaguely appropriate for the Middle East part of the world versus, you know, the standard swimsuit style costume and whatnot. Of course, on the very next page after we first see her in it, she's immediately taking off the head covering, which seems like that's the part of it that made it sort of appropriate in that part of the world partially. You know, it felt like they were going almost a half measure for her trying to respect the cultures over there.
Yeah, the whole sequence, and I actually think the sequence after this with her having a drink with the negotiator, that costume is even weirder. It's almost like military fatigues, but she's kind of got the Wonder Woman girdle thing.
Yeah, she's got like an armor breastplate on.
Yes.
And where did she switch to that? Why is she out of the other thing? It was puzzling. Yeah. And that scene before and this scene, all of that's about 18 or 20 pages, so about the equivalent of a full comic book issue.
Yeah.
And we spend a lot of time with this guy, this Dr. Leon Zyko, and his last name's given at the end of the scene. We don't get his first name until a couple of scenes later. And that's kind of a trend in this book of we see somebody and find out later who they are. And not only did it take a little bit after a lengthy conversation that they had to find out his name as kind of he's leaving or whatever, but then the next page we see the cane and realize, oh, he's the one we almost saw at the beginning of the book.
Yes.
So there's a lot of withholding of information in this story, and that's a technique authors have to do to tell stories. I get it, but there was a point where it was getting a little annoying, and to have the Dr. Psycho tag just dropped in a caption that way. So we get the reveal of his last name, the reveal of, oh, he's the one that, you know, the people with the VR suits said after Wonder Woman, and oh, now we know he's Dr. Psycho because that's dropped on us. I feel there was a better way that information could have gotten out.
Yeah.
And Dr. Psycho is a longtime Wonder Woman villain. Usually he's got a beard and a mustache and is about half as tall. I also thought the mechanical bug that was zipping around during the scene and whatnot was really obvious in a couple of places and then just invisible in other places.
Yeah.
It gets explained as a surveillance device, so I wasn't the least bit surprised by that. And then, again, after about a full issue's worth of story with that guy, we cut back finally, although not obviously, to the tour of Project Ares.
Yep. Which, again, it's confusing only in who that is running Project Ares.
We get his name a couple of scenes later.
We do, but let me get there. It's just...
Maxwell Lord, who's a familiar name in the Wonder Woman mythology and stuff.
Yes.
More Justice League, I guess.
Absolutely. Which we absolutely... Yes. Once you know it's Maxwell Lord, you know it's Maxwell Lord. But on the page, the way the caption is, you got the bug, and then that page you have... by Dr. Zyko. They're all just the same. And that is directly above Maxwell Lord. And you're like, oh, is this the same guy later in a different place.
Yeah, you could have applied to Dr. Psycho either to Leon Zyko or the guy giving Phil the tour.
Or both, which is where I think I found myself initially.
They look sufficiently different, and I took it as happening at the same time.
Okay, yeah, and see, that's why I wasn't sure about the timeline.
No, that's fair, that's fair. I was assuming it was the same time because we'd cut back and forth, but there could have been clearer storytelling, absolutely. And there were a few places like, well, really, the first page where we see Maxwell Lord, I don't feel we get a really good look at his face.
Nope.
He's squinting in the first one, he's heavily inked in the second panel, and just kind of sketched out in the third. And again, not a problem, but then the next page, we get no face in the first panel, he's not in the second, he's far in the background in the third, and he's in shadow in the fourth.
Yeah, and then you get that close-up on the eyes, which again, it's unclear who that is.
I took that as being Phil, his reaction shot to the armed response environment suit, which is the Ares of Project Ares.
Yeah, but Phil tends to have a mix of gray and light brown hair, but those eyebrows are very dark, which again looks like Dr. Zyko there.
He's got brownish, darkish eyebrows in the scene before we get to the Middle East.
Before we get to the Middle East, okay.
Again, that was some 20 pages back.
Yeah.
And while he's got gray in the hair, he doesn't seem to have it in the eyebrows. That's why I took the eyebrows as his. I'm trying to see if we ever get it, because Zyko's got brown eyes.
Yeah, and this one's clearly green. That's the one thing you can definitely tell.
Which you can definitely see in the scene with him and Trevor after that.
Yeah.
But this is one where you've got to kind of piece some stuff together to figure out what the hell's going on.
Exactly. Yeah, whether it's the art or the storytelling or the script, it's not overly clear who everyone is and when everyone is.
Yeah. Well, and what is it about Maxwell Lord that have people referring to him as the boy most likely to start World War III?
Yeah.
I mean, with the Project Ares, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just trying to think what led to that reputation. And then, of course, let's cut back to Paradise Island, because sure, why not? And I was unclear why Hippolyta was going to the oracles to get her fate or whatever, because we never really... I guess that's the three fates up there, although it's not totally clear here.
But it's almost implied that it's the other way around, right?
Well, this is where Yoda speak, Amazons do, kind of annoyed me.
Because she says, why would the fates consult with Hippolyta? And you're like...
No. What they say is, why would the fates Hippolyta consult?
Yes. Okay.
And the word order is putting the verb at the end, so I took it as, why would Hippolyta consult the fates?
Okay, and again, the word order is confusing and...
And inconsistent with the first book.
Yes. And again, again, with the word order, you can read it as the fates came to consult with Hippolyta, which, like, yeah. And again, as they point out, her fate's kind of known. What do they need her for? That was what the first book was all about.
Yeah. There were enough places where the, I almost want to say Shakespearean, not quite iambic pentameter, but the almost theatrical nature of the way the Amazons were speaking, and particularly the inverted word order in places, it got really annoying.
Yeah.
And it didn't faze me at all, because I don't think it was in the first book at all, but man, at this one, it got in the way. As clearly, it made you interpret that scene differently than how I interpreted that scene. So, I think there's some stylistic choices that creators need to be careful when they make to not, you know, impede the understanding of the story.
Yeah.
I did think Trevor coming to Diana saying, hey, you know, you've got problems. Here's what's going on. People are coming after you. I thought that was well done.
Yeah.
The whole bit with her then getting into the Wonder Woman outfit and doing the bullets and bracelets with Zyko, I thought was weird. Like, what led to that? And going from, you know, a shot or two from a pistol to, let's try the machine gun. Okay. Interesting. A little aggressive.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's her suggestion, not his.
Yes. I don't know how much experience she'd had with machine guns at that point. I guess she'd had a little with the Jeep throwing scene in the first book. She just seemed really confident of herself.
Yeah.
And he seemed really comfortable with the machine gun.
Fair.
Which, given what happens with him and stuff, not too surprising. Because he's doing this whole mind game on her, trying to, you know, earn her trust and really, I don't say take advantage of her, but literally, that's exactly what he does. So this is a very different take on Dr. Psycho than we've gotten before in Silver Age and stuff. He was a mentalist illusionist type, I believe. Whereas this guy is just a regular human in terms of no superpowers or whatever, but really smart and incredibly manipulative.
Okay.
When we get to her being at his place and he's like, oh, you know, I have to trust you, but you won't trust me. I mean, blatantly, she, you know, playing on her, manipulating her to get what he wants. And this is where, you know, kind of the evil maniacal laugh would come into play. And, you know, this is where we magically find out that the lasso not only has truth powers, but apparently crazy hypnotic powers.
Is that the lasso, or does that somehow just make her able to be hypnotized, or I don't know?
I took it as the lasso, but because he tells her to be quiet and not move a muscle. So I don't, I mean, maybe he's hypnotized her too, but that part wasn't clear.
Yeah, well, because when he's tied, the first shot after he ties her wrist with the lasso, the look in her eyes, you can almost argue she's hypnotized at that point.
Yeah, it was a little unclear.
Yeah.
She's definitely in a trance for most of that scene.
Yes.
It was unclear what the post-hypnotic suggestion, I guess it's later when she kind of starts to declare war or whatever. But, I mean, he set this whole thing up to get Trevor there. Trevor sees her in not so good of a state. He attacks Psycho. Psycho uses that. See, I told you he was, you know, a threat to you or whatever. And the whole, you know, mind game and stuff like that kicks into high gear, which wasn't the story I was expecting them to tell. The minute I heard Project Ares, I was expecting Ares to be the main bad guy, not Dr. Psycho.
Okay.
And not saying Dr. Psycho was a bad choice, but it just felt like, this almost felt like the kind of story you would have a Lex Luthor kind of manipulation on Superman or whatever. If you can't outpower him, outsmart him. It makes sense to do a similar thing here with Wonder Woman. It just, I don't know. I couldn't tell what his motivation was in some of this. And part of it is we've got 128 pages and the story is playing out a lot slower in some respects than it normally would in a monthly comic, because you'd be doing more in every 20-page chunk, yet faster because we're able to read it all at once.
Yeah.
We do the FaceTime via the magic device or whatever with her mom again, and then this is where Paula is unable to get, or is, I guess, taken back over by the brainwashing because of the radio signal. I mean, this whole part got a little confused as well as to how exactly did they brainwash her 40, 50, 60, 80 years ago, and there's still a signal trying to activate her?
Yeah.
That part didn't make sense. And then the gruesome end for Hippolyta. Again, wasn't surprised. It's kind of the payoff for the intro scene with Paula and such. I felt it was not a good move. I think Hippolyta is a character. Keeping her around makes sense. They obviously chose not to go that way by fairly gruesomely killing her off, and definitively killing her off. I don't think this is a purple ray can fix this kind of situation. And then, you know, we cut back to Diana, you know, at a woman power rally saying we must seize power and such, that Maxwell Lord is able to say, oh, it's a declaration of war. Let's get those suits out. Let's go do some stuff. It just felt almost cliche. The plot didn't seem to have any particular subtlety to it other than let's get in her good graces, brainwash her, have her prove to be the threat we want to paint her as so we can go demolish her and I guess go attack the Amazons. It seems like a plot that would not have worked with the classic Wonder Woman of at least the Silver Age, probably not even of the modern age in the New 52 and Rebirth era. Almost definitely not, because that one's the goddess of truth and would not be able to be manipulated this way. I'm also a little puzzled how Paula found them so fast, because she's taken off from Paradise Island, crashes into that trailer to confront Diana, still holding Hippolyta's heart in her hand. Just like, geez, gross. But effective in terms of a psyop kind of a move to really get under her skin and prove, I mean, how would she know that's her mother's heart? But, you know, whatever.
Oh, but she's wearing Ares' girdle, which...
clearly got that from Mom. No argument there. But she could have just stolen that quietly and snuck off, having claimed to kill Hippolyta and not. But obviously she did. We saw it.
Yes.
It was just unclear to me if the timing was coincidental. Was she getting in the way of Psycho's plan? Was this something that had been planned literally for decades? I don't think the story was as tight and sensible in this one as it kind of felt in the first book.
That I agree.
They seem to be able to, Wonder Woman is able to take care of subduing Paula fairly quickly and easily. And then the champions just magically show up at the right time, at the right place to pick up Paula. That was convenient. And then, you know, we kind of get the mirror bookend scene back at the space transporter. We see the butterfly wings of the women and such. And this goes back to, you can't brainwash, but it's okay if we do, that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
The part that disappointed me the most about all of this is we'd set up the Ares suits, hadn't used them. We've put Wonder Woman now as Queen of the Amazons. There is tension between the Amazons and at least the United States, which has all these Ares suits ready to go. And we end with the threat of war between the Amazons and Project Ares,
mm-hmm.
which has to be the story of the next book.
Yes.
I mean, this ended on a bit of a cliffhanger, so I was expecting more of a done-in-one sort of a story, and we sort of got that, but not entirely.
Yeah, no, not much at all. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I struggled with this one. The art's still outstanding. I think the story's got plot problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really disagree with the point that I feel the author's trying to make as well.
Yeah, I think this version of Amazon culture and mindset is not as much to my liking as some other ones. I would say probably for me the best version was, I guess it was Greg Rucka's version where Diana was literally an ambassador from Themyscira.
Yeah.
And like the issue he did with Lois Lane interviewing her and stuff was brilliant stuff. You know, we got a feel for that culture, and it was everything you would almost want a culture to be or whatever. Whereas this one, it's like, I could see where people would be legitimately, the more they learn about Amazons, more worried and more fearful of them. And that doesn't seem like a good thing.
Yeah, no. And yeah, personally, I always preferred John Byrne's Wonder Woman and that version, which was, I don't know, the archaeologist / Greek myth in the modern world, kind of studying and helping humanity study the humanities.
Isn't that the run that had her working as at like a fast food place or something?
For parts. It had her starting as like director of like archaeology and history at a museum.
Yeah, there were some parts of Byrne's run I didn't particularly care for.
That's also where Cassie came from, or at least the version I liked.
True, true. I'm not saying it was all bad. I'm just saying there were some parts that I think were bad.
Yes. Fair enough.
But you can say that about almost any run of any property. I think the first book here was much stronger than the second book.
Yep.
And I am fully expecting a third book based on where this ends, particularly with the words "to be concluded."
Yeah.
Which implies a third and not a fourth.
It doesn't, though.
I expect the third one to end with a note of finality, not to say they could not do a fourth, but the fourth would be the start of a new story with these characters.
Yeah. Again, to be concluded could easily mean, hey, there's only one more part of this story being part two of this one. Yeah, I don't know.
The problem I have with that is this 2.5 year break between installments.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, you know, somewhere in all the old two-part Batman episodes, I think there was a to be concluded thrown in occasionally in there. And it didn't mean the show was wrapping up. It meant the story was.
No, and that's fair. But we're getting a continued saga across books of the Superman one. Same with the Batman one. Whereas this feels like we're getting a sense of closure, if not total closure, at least of this story next volume.
Yeah.
Which at this point is going to be maybe a year from now, you know, April, May of 2021. Maybe.
Maybe.
So I get that these things take a lot more time to do than just an issue of a comic or even a 6-issue run of a comic, but for them to be coming out slower than sequels to movies disappoints me and I think does not do well for this Earth One line.
Yeah, and we talked about that quite a bit and I tend to agree with you last time. It would be nice if they were a little more timely, I guess is the right word.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be easier for it to maintain momentum if they would just come out at a not quite a snail's pace. So the March 2020 sales data have finally come out at the tail end of April here. So as soon as we can coordinate between the two of us and Eric, we'll get together and talk about that. It is sounding like, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the episode, that Diamond should be starting to release new books on May 20th, hopefully. Other distributors of UCS and Lunar, I think, are already distributing DC books. Not a ton of them, but a couple. So new comics are coming. The April 2020 order form through Diamond is looking like it'll be due around, I don't know, May 20th or thereabouts. But check with your retailer. All of that is still, you know, not quite solidified. And not only when it'll be due, but some of the items that were in that previews that we got before Diamond stopped shipping stuff may be coming out later because some of the publishers are slowing down their release schedule as everything kind of ramps back up. So we'll see what happens with all of that. And then the recommendation roundtable, still accepting submissions for that. We've gotten one of those episodes out. Hopefully people have listened to it and enjoyed it. And we'll send in some clips. We don't have deadlines on it. As soon as I get enough clips to put together an episode, I'll put one together and release it. Anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think I'm good.
Cool. Join us next time as James and I continue our look at Doomsday Clock, focusing on issues 7 through 9, and then in 2 weeks, as Sam and I are back to go through some more of the Earth 1 hardcovers, we're going to do Teen Titans Earth 1 Volume 2 and Green Lantern Earth 1 Volume 1.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.